I wonder if anybody comes up to Steve Railsback today and says, "I loved you in Nuki."
Radio Drone. It's the mid-80s. I'm Josh Hadley. I work for Galan and Globus. Oh, I only wish I did. This is Radio Drome. I'm Josh Hadley. With me, as always, is Cecil Barely Awake Trachtenberg.
I would also like to work for Galan and Globus.
Well, considering that one of them's dead and canon's non-existent anymore, we can only do that if we travel through time. Stumped you, didn't I?
You can tell that I'm tired.
All right. Back this week is Peter. Look, I actually showed up. Gajic.
Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2 is a comedy?
No. And joining us this week is Brandon, what the hell am I doing here, Tenold?
Hey, you know, I have a time machine if you want to borrow it. It's just as long as you give it back after or before you borrowed it. It's a time machine, but yeah.
Well, because if it's a time machine, does it even matter if we borrow it or if we want to borrow it and then give it back, since nothing will have happened to it, to your perspective, did anything happen to it?
As long as you give it back, then let's say no.
There you go. If you guys want to do something for the future, you can go to adamandeve.com. Use the promo code DROME, and you will get 10 free gifts on top of whatever you order. You'll get 6 free DVDs, a free mystery gift, a gift for him, a gift for her, and free U.S. shipping, all for using the promo code DROME at adamandeve.com. Now, we're going to travel back in time, though, to the mid-80s, Canon Films, and we're going to look at the 3 Tobe Hooper films that Canon put out, all 3 of which were disasters critically and financially, although I like all 3 of them. We're going to examine each of these and what happened, because I think this was a very unique time in both Canon's history, but in horror sci-fi as well. Because you're coming off of E.T., you're coming off of The Thing, Blade Runner and whatnot, and the sci-fi field is opening up. You've got Galan and Globus pouring millions and millions of dollars into these things, and them failing one after another. And then you've got a unique director like Tobe Hooper just finding no luck at the box office again and again and again after the Poltergeist debacle. It was just, this basically is what sealed his career to the direct-to-video hell he's in right now. So without going into each specific film, what do you think of the 3 Canon Tobe Hooper films as a whole?
I'm actually a big fan of Life Force. I think that's a movie that deserves much more of a cult reputation than it has. I like Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2 after several years of hating it when I first saw it when I was young, but I warmed up to it considerably. Invaders from Mars is the one I like the least. I feel like that one doesn't work quite as well as the other two, but it's still got good things about it. And yeah, it really is a shame that especially the first two I mentioned, they failed at the box office and got such a hostile critical reaction, because I really don't think they deserved it.
I think there are 3 movies that were just not advertised properly, especially Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2. I mean, I'm pretty sure not only was it not so well received theatrically, but even like even Golem and Globus themselves didn't like it, because they were like, this is funny and comedic. What's going on here? Why is this? They didn't even understand that it was meant to be a satirical film. So I think the biggest fault of these movies not doing well, and they're very good movies. They're all of them have a fun sort of, half satire, half real horror sort of vibe to them. Life Force has some good comedic moments and some good like action and horror moments. Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2 has some really good gruesome moments, but also some really funny stuff too. And Invaders from Mars is obviously kind of meant to be satirical. And I think not only did the audiences not understand, but Golem and Globus themselves didn't get what they were actually getting from Tobe Hooper and completely mismarketed them, which is such a shame, because they are some of his works that stand out next to, you know, the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre and stuff. Like, I Life Force is a movie I'd really like more people to see, because it's a pretty unique film. You got the space vampires, and which is pretty awesome. So I think they are three just unfortunately mismarketed films that are actually awesome.
Life Force is probably one of my all-time favorite sci-fi movies. It's just amazing. Now I'm talking the director's European cut. That theatrical version is the one that I saw first, and I liked it, but I felt like there was something missing, and then it turned out that there was something missing. I mean, the score is different. There's a lot of changes that they made for the US cut, and it doesn't feel the same, but the European cut is just a brilliant, brilliant movie, and it's the epic sci-fi movie that Tobe Hooper set out to make. He wanted to make this just massive film, and he succeeded. The Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2 is a real sidestep from the first one. And I don't say that in a negative way. It's just that the first one is such a gritty, just dismal horror film. And the second one is so tongue-in-cheek, satirical, and goofy, full of just hilarious moments and some good scares and whatnot. But it definitely is more on, you know, the comedy side of the horror comedy that a lot of people just didn't get, because, again, they went in expecting Texas Chainsaw 1, and they got what Texas Chainsaw 2 ended up being. Invaders from Mars, I think that the production value in Invaders from Mars is great. I like the aliens are just these really bizarre, weirdo-looking creatures. And it's another one that has a nice tongue-in-cheek nature to it, because it does kind of present itself almost like a family movie, but it's not. And I've never seen the original one, so I can't compare the two. But it's of the three, it's my least favorite of the three. But it's still, I think it's like a good movie.
Let's go back to 1985. Actually, let's go back to 1982. Tobe Hooper's coming off of Poltergeist, and there's the whole who really directed Poltergeist fiasco that's following him. He doesn't do much for a little while. So then this newer company, Canon had been around since the 70s, but Glahn and Globus didn't buy it until 1979, technically. They're still relatively up-and-comers at this point. Canon is really starting to make a name for themselves with their philosophy. I mean, yes, I'm boiling it down here. B movies on A budgets. They basically looked at like Roger Corman-type movies, Charles Band-type movies. Those usually have $1 million budget at most. What happens if we make those same kind of movies, which are always fan favorites, but we throw $20, $30 million at these films? So we're going to make these B movies now A movies. So they approached Tobe Hooper. Now, Canon had this reputation for exclusivity. That's why, like, when they signed Charles Bronson or Chuck Norris, pretty much any movie you saw from Chuck Norris or Charles Bronson in the 80s was a Canon film, because they would sign people for exclusive deals. Based on Poltergeist, they signed Tobe Hooper for an exclusive three-picture deal. So basically, Glahn and Globus signed Tobe Hooper for a three-picture exclusivity deal. So his next three films would be mega-budgeted movies here. They had been trying to make what the movie that would become Life Force. It was called Space Vampires at that point, based on the Colin Wilson novel. They'd been trying to make Space Vampires for a little while and having no luck. Well, Tobe Hooper saw some potential in this. He went and hired Dan O'Bannon to adapt the book. And if you've ever read the book, by adapt, basically change everything. All Dan O'Bannon basically left was the premise and some of the broad strokes. So it's not so much Colin Wilson's novel as it's Dan O'Bannon's movie. The movie had, correct me if I'm wrong, Cecil, one of the longest shooting schedules ever up to that point. Wasn't it 126 days for principal photography?
They said it was roughly 120 days over the course of 6 months.
That is insane for a movie in the 80s. Yeah,
absolutely insane. I mean, that just is ridiculously long. But the thing was, they needed that time to do every, you know, I mean, they had the budget and they, you know, they just needed that time in order to do all the effects and everything, because there were some effects that took like days to do.
The movie had a $25 million budget, which was Canon's largest budget ever at that point. Film, I think all $25 million is definitely on the screen, but the film only brought in $11.6 million off of that. So it didn't do so hot. It was released on the first day of summer 1985 in a severely truncated form. We lost between 14 and 20 minutes. As Cecil pointed out, the score was changed. That's the version we all saw. Director's cut was released on Laserdisc in the mid-90s, or really the international cut. It's kind of funny when you look at why this film failed here, but did not in Europe. In Europe, they got the full version, where it was critically lauded as being a really great film. Here, we got the truncated version, where it was eviscerated for making no sense whatsoever.
Well, the other thing that happened was when it released, it was up. It got released against Rambo, Cocoon, and The Goonies. All three of those ended up being in the top 10 highest grossing film, the top 10 highest grossing films of 1985. So right out of the gate, it had the deck stacked against it. Sucks, because it's like you got to look at it from that perspective. Like back then, you know, nobody knew that these movies were going to be that huge. You look at it now, and you're like, holy crap, you know, like, of course everybody went to see these other movies. And the other thing that I think kind of screwed them over was just Cannon's reputation. People were seeing Cannon movies as what some, as they talked about in the documentary, the Electric Boogaloo documentary, they were seeing them as a schlock factory. And a lot of times they weren't piling people in. Like if it had, you know, 20th Century Fox in front of it or something, people probably would have rolled in and, oh my God, this movie is going to be amazing. And they probably would have had maybe a better ad campaign. But when it came out, oh, it's Cannon. Oh, this movie is probably going to be another, you know, just dumb knockoff of something else, a bad alien ripoff or whatnot. And instead, they had some incredible talent going behind it. They had John Dykstra. They had Alan Hume, who was the DOP of the Bond movies. They had just so many incredibly talented people working with them and just making this film that, like you said, it cost $25 million, but it's all up on the screen. There was not a cent wasted.
In fact, I'm surprised it only cost $25 million. It looks way more expensive than that.
Oh, God, the ending is like London is on fire. and there's hundreds of bodies everywhere. And it's incredible. John Dykstra's optical effects flying all over the place and buildings are exploding. I mean, it's epic. And for people that just kind of knock this off now, it's that movie with the girl with the tits that walks around. It's like you're missing the point. It's like, yes, it's a movie where there is a very beautiful woman who's walking around completely naked. But that's kind of the rub is like, OK, here's this girl who's walking around completely naked, does not give a shit. And something's wrong. Like she's just everybody who comes up to her, she just absorbs them, and it starts this plague that is getting out of control, and they're harvesting the souls of humans to kind of take up to their ship.
To a degree, AIDS was a new thing, so I highly doubt Dan O'Bannon had an analogy for AIDS in this, but I think it was venereal disease. Dan O'Bannon's very open about the fact that, yeah, she is a naked woman who, if she gets close to you, spreads a disease which you spread to other people. And then there's that line that one of the scientists has when the SAS guy is asking him, was it sexual? He's like, overwhelmingly so. So this whole movie is also an allegory to VD, if you think about it, and how quickly it spreads. And Dan O'Bannon's a smart enough writer that was all intentional.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, having a version that was obviously completely different from what it was theatrically, that didn't help because, yeah, the theatrical cut in a lot of ways doesn't make sense. There's a lot of stuff that's left out. It feels like more of a just sort of random B-movie. It still looks great. You still see all of the budget on the screen, but so much of the plot is left out that nothing makes sense. It was marketed poorly, which is unfortunate because it really is an awesome film. And yeah, there is a naked lady that walks around. There's also space vampires and weird demon things that are killing everybody. And London is on fire and stuff. It's great. And Patrick Stewart screaming and going crazy for no reason. It's a pretty great movie.
And making out with Steve Railsback. Patrick Stewart makes out with Steve Railsback,
and making out with Steve Railsback. That's right. That happens. And it's the movie itself is just an experience of all these crazy things that Toby Hooper wanted to put up on the screen. And a testament to, again, Dan O'Bannon's awesome writing. It is an a sort of an allegory for spreading venereal disease or AIDS or something like that. I feel like it's a movie that does deserve to get a lot of widespread praise, because there's a movie with a very similar sort of plot. It's obviously much more low key, but It Follows is basically about like an alien sexually transmitted disease that goes around killing people. It's a kind of a more downplayed version of Life Force. So I think if something like It Follows can get such notoriety and people love it so much, then people should also be checking out Life Force to be seeing other kinds of movies that tackle those sorts of concepts.
And I also want to point out, am I the only one that thought the last half hour turned into a giant Quatermass film?
Yeah,
no, that was absolutely intentional.
I'm sure it was.
Yeah, for to get into why it failed, like we talked about the whole, you know, it wasn't marketed well and they cut lots out of it. Also, another small factor is I think both Cannon and Toby Hooper and the movie were sort of victims of their own ambition, because like you said, this was the biggest budgeted movie that Cannon had ever done, and I think that Toby Hooper had ever done. I think the budget for this was bigger than Poltergeist, if I'm
not
mistaken.
Oh yeah, the budget was almost $10 million more than Poltergeist.
Yeah, and I mean, if you just read like a one or two sentence summary of the plot, like it's, you know, vampires from outer space, and the female lead spends 90%
You're going to lose most people right there.
Naked. Yeah, it sounds like you're describing some low-budget Jess Franco movie that was shot in 2 weeks, and Toby Hooper actually had the balls to try and make a multi-million dollar would-be blockbuster out of it. You know, unfortunately, it didn't pay off for him, but I applaud the guy for having the balls to attempt it. And of course, even in the full cut of it where the plot makes more sense, there's still tons of just crazy ideas and explaining lots of weird concepts like how to kill the space vampires. It's got to be a certain type of metal and you got to stab them. What is it? It has to be 2 inches below where the heart would be, or, you know, things like that. And weird scenes like Steve Railsback making out with Patrick Stewart, or later where they're in the helicopter and the
Matilda May's made out of blood. That is an amazing effect.
Matilda May, and then it forms into Matilda May. I off the top of my head, I can't think of any other movie with anything similar to that. Mm-hmm. Like, you're only going to see that in Life Force. And it's a real shame that either people haven't heard of it, or if you hear the movie mentioned, they usually think of it as some sort of turkey. Like, you'd think they were talking about a movie like Troll 2 or something like that. Like, the only reason to watch this movie is to laugh at it, which is completely misguided, I think.
You brought up the goofy elements. That's what Toby Hooper wanted the movie to focus on. Part of the problem was he said that they advertised this movie poorly. He said they advertised it as a very serious, his words, 2001 type thriller, and he said they downplayed the sillier elements of the film, which he thinks might have helped the box office. So he outright blames the trailer for why this movie failed, and I kind of agree. It's a good trailer, but it's not representative of the film. So I do kind of agree. Cannon dropped the ball on this one by cutting it, by changing it, and then by marketing it poorly. I blame this one on Cannon. This one's Cannon's fault.
I think it's Cannon's fault, because they have done that with not just that movie, but other, like, they went and changed a bunch of stuff from, like, let's say, like, Exterminator 2 is an example where they completely changed the ending. They changed certain parts in the movie. There were stuff filmed they didn't end up using that they included in the trailer, and then made a completely different ending instead, because for whatever reason they weren't happy with that cut. And who knows, the movie might have actually done better had it have been released in its original way, much like with Life Force. It would have made more sense. And I think if they had advertised it in the way that the movie actually was, because it's not like a super serious 2001 A Space Odyssey type movie. It is a B movie that looks like an A movie with a lot of really cool concepts and some satirical stuff and some funny moments, but also some really badass moments. And I think if they were to actually advertise it like that, more people possibly would have gone to see it, especially if it were released in its original cut.
I don't think any blame can be laid at Toby Hooper's feet. So yeah, and also I'm just going to say, I think audiences too. I think a lot of people probably weren't willing to give a multi-million dollar space vampire epic a chance.
Absolutely, Cannon. And it's sad because Canon usually is fairly hands off. I think they learned, but this was still relatively early on. And I think they had so much riding on it because they were like, when they went to Hooper to, you know, when he showed him his director's cut, they were like, okay, that's great. That'll play perfect in Europe, but it won't fly in the US. It's too long. So we need to cut it down. So he even supervised the, Hooper supervised the American cut. And it just, I mean, try as you might, you know, if the movie, it needs to be 2 hours long to tell the story, it needs to be 2 hours long. There are times where there's just stuff that you're going to cut that you can't. I mean, there are movies where, all right, yeah, maybe this character could be nixed or there's something that can be taken out. But sometimes it just doesn't work, especially on a movie that's like this big in scale. So unfortunately, Canon really kind of screwed the pooch on this one.
Well, Canon didn't see it that way. They blamed Hooper for it. So he still had two pictures left on his three-picture deal. When he started making Invaders from Mars, they cut his budget. Now he's only got $7 million. They're not going to give him $25 million again. Now we're into shooting is in 1985, although the movie will come out on June 6, 1986. Invaders from Mars had problems right from the get-go. Now, the original 1953 Invaders from Mars is a public domain film. There's this piece of shit out there named Wade Williams. He calls himself a film archivist. What he does is he buys up public domain films, buys up the master prints, alters them, recopyrights them, which was what you can do if you alter them, and he puts Wade Williams Presents in whatever the movie is. And then he tries to buy up every print, and you got to remember, in the 80s and late 70s, this was much easier to do. He would buy up every print that does not say Wade Williams Presents on it, so that way, even though the movie's public domain, good luck finding a print that's not his copyrighted version. That's what he did with Invaders from Mars. He heard that Canon wanted to remake the movie, public domain movie. They didn't have to buy the rights. He came in and said, whoa, hey, you guys didn't pay me. Rather than fight him in court, they made him an executive producer on the film, and they paid him off rather than fight him in court. That was the first mistake on the film, is having Wade Williams involved. It's almost a straight remake, which is not necessarily a bad thing. And it's not necessarily a good thing. I think it was Cecil that pointed out earlier, the monster redesigns are really clever and they're really fun. It's got a mostly great cast, and it just doesn't work. For some reason, the film doesn't work. I don't care about the kid. I don't care about his parents. I cared about the military angle. In all honesty, I thought James Caron was a fun as hell character. Mm-hmm. I wanted to see more of James Caron in this, not Hunter Carson. So, I don't know. Invaders from Mars, it looks great. It just does not work for me at all. And one thing that I think Tobe Hooper totally screwed up on this film. The original 1953 film is all shot, because the movie is taking place from a child's perspective, it's all shot at low upward angles to give a child's perspective on what everything looks like. And that really does play in the 1953 version. It doesn't here. Hooper shot this like a 1980s monster movie. So you kind of lose the child's perspective thing, which, even though they kept the idiotic twist ending, makes no sense when it's not shot from a child's perspective.
I mean, it's been a while since I've seen it, so I can't argue everything. I just kind of dug it from like a production level. I thought a lot of the stuff was cool. I kind of agree with you. The kid was annoying.
Do you know how Hunter Carson got cast?
How?
That's Karen Black's son.
Oh, really?
And Karen Black is the star of the movie. Another bit of idiotic trivia. That horrendous actor, Hunter Carson, was the original Bud Bundy.
Oh, dear.
In the original Married with Children pilot, that was Bud Bundy. And he gave the same quality performance that he gives here, which is annoying as hell. Just wanted to point that out. Keep going, Cecil.
Yeah, there are a lot of times where you'll watch a movie. Like, I just watched a movie called, did a movie called Witchery. And there's a kid in the movie who, he obviously is somebody, the producer's kid, or because this kid is awful. It's like every line is, we are buying that house over there. Like, just reading off of, you know, somebody's holding up a piece of paper with those lines on it off camera. But with Invaders from Mars, the kid was annoying and, like, you know, not Last Action Hero level of annoying, but, you know, still irritating. And I thought it was kind of cool. It was definitely the weakest of the three, but still, it showed creativity and it was, like, fun. Not something I'm going out of my way to watch, but it definitely not on par with Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2 and nowhere near Life Force.
No, I understand where you're coming from. Like I said earlier, this is easily my least favorite of the three movies Tobe Hooper made for Canon. I think the movie's okay, but it's not as ambitious or as trippy and out there as Life Force. And it's also, even though it has a few funny moments, like where the one guy's trying to talk to the alien and then he ends up getting blasted, but overall it's not nearly as funny as Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2. Like they were saying, the designs of the aliens is kind of cool. This kind of goes to what you were saying before, where even though in terms of the look of it and the design of it, it's different from the original, plot-wise, it's very similar. And this was at a time where you had a lot of remakes of 50s sci-fi movies, like John Carpenter's version of The Thing or Cronenberg's version of The Fly, where they took the idea of the original movie, but then took it in some very different directions. And this movie didn't really do that, other than, I guess, shooting from regular angles instead of upward angles. So, yeah, I don't hate the movie, but I think it's easily the least of Tobe Hooper's canon films.
I think Brandon put it pretty well in terms of it's not as out there as Life Force, and it's not really the same level of goofy comedic that Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2 is, and it is kind of just a straight remake, but doesn't have the sort of originality of the original with the upward angle and stuff like that. It is the weakest one. I would have to agree with that. I think visually it's a nice looking film. The aliens look cool. You know, some of the lighting and shots and stuff look pretty nice. But overall, it's one that I don't find myself going back to all that often. Like, I'm definitely more on the side of Life Force and Chainsaw 2 as far as, like, you know, Toby's better work goes. But yeah, Invaders from Mars, I think it's pretty obvious that there were budget cuts, that it didn't let him use as much money. And that was another one that they were very unhappy with. Again, like, it seemed like they thought he was going to make much more of a serious sort of scary alien movie, and then they watched it and were very disappointed with what it ended up being.
Well, so were audiences and critics. This one, $7 million budget, $4.9 million domestic take. So again, they lost money on this. So it was at this point they decided, Canon was like, okay, this Tobe Hooper thing's not working out the way we wanted it to. We've given him a ton of money and he hasn't made any back. So we've got a problem here. We still got another picture. This time they took not much more creative control, because Toby, you know, like Wakey pointed out earlier, they didn't like how Texas Chainsaw 2 turned out. They cut his budget after he started filming. His original budget was $6 million for this movie. After they began filming, they cut his budget to $4.7 million for Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2. Now, this was shot almost back-to-back with Invaders from Mars, to the point where he had to start pre-production on Texas Chainsaw 2 while still in the editing phase of Invaders from Mars, which might also explain why that movie didn't turn out so well, as he was basically making two films at the same time. Here, he decided he didn't want to repeat himself with Texas Chainsaw Massacre. He didn't want to just make a straight sequel. So he's like, let's make a satire of Texas Chainsaw Massacre. That's not what he told Canon, though. He told Canon he was making a horror film. He didn't tell them he was making a satire film. And he defends that if he had, they probably wouldn't have let him make it. So to his credit, he did slip one under the radar there. But Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2, fantastic film. I think I actually like it better than the first film on a rewatchability level. Here's the problem. Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2 ran into even worse promotion and marketing disasters than Invaders from Mars and Life Force did, because when they submitted the film to the MPAA, it came back with an X rating. NC-17 won't exist for another few years. Came back with an X rating and with the stipulation, no amount of cuts will get this to an R. So they're stuck with, we've got a movie we can't market. Because back then, an X-rated film. You can't advertise in a newspaper, which was the chief way of getting the movie out there, and you can't advertise on television. So all of a sudden, it's like half of their advertising potential is gone. They could only advertise on radio and in horror movie magazines, essentially. So Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2, it's almost a fluke. This is the one that made money. The one they couldn't advertise made back almost double its budget. How in the hell does that happen?
Well, I think obviously the biggest part of that one was just the name of it, the fact that it was, you know, the sequel to the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. I didn't read any specific reviews of the movie when it first came out, but from what I understand, the reaction from both critics and, like, even though it made money, a lot of audiences really hostile to this movie when it first came out. I can sympathize because when I first saw this when I was a teenager, I hated this movie with a passion. Because, like a lot of people at that time, I was just expecting a straight-up sequel to the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and that's not what the movie is at all. But now that I can actually see the movie and appreciate it for what it is, I actually like it quite a bit. I won't say I like it more than the first one, but I think it is a very good sequel. And I also, again, I appreciate the fact that Tobe Hooper didn't just repeat itself, because there are a lot of sequels that are just lazy and they're essentially rehashes of the first movie, like the same plot but with different actors, you know, playing characters with different names. I like the fact that he did something different with this one. And, you know, for all the reputation the first movie has for being, you know, people who haven't seen it think it's this super gory movie when really it's not. And then you have this one, which is much more comedic and parodic in nature, but it's also a lot bloodier than the first movie.
Yeah, this one is super gory to a significant degree.
And to the point where they have parts that are, you know, sick jokes in the best sense of the term. Like, there's parts where you're sort of horrified and laughing at the same time.
If they had left in Joe Bob Briggs' deleted scene, that would have been the perfect example of horror and funny. Joe Bob Briggs, in his scene that was cut, and it's weird how Joe Bob got into the movie. He was a big proponent of the first film, and he was working for Rolling Stone at the time, and they sent him to Texas to cover the making of the movie. And so Toby's like, hey, you want a cameo? Yeah, sure, why not? So he was playing himself as a really scumbag movie critic coming out of a movie theater, and he gets jumped by Leatherface, and he's making Joe Bob Briggs style commentary over his two female co-stars being butchered in front of him. And it was cut for time, and I can see that, because according to Tobe Hooper, and I agree, it's a 3-minute scene that stops the movie dead. He said, like, the momentum just stops dead where this was. So I agree, the scene probably deserved to be cut, but it was a hilariously funny scene.
Oh, well, we still have Dennis Hopper doing some chainsaw foo at the hardware store, so.
I'm bringing it down!
I am the Lord of the Harvest.
4 stars.
I'm the Lord of the Harvest. Bring it down. That may be one of Dennis Hopper's best roles ever. I love Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2. I think it's a solid example of how to do a sequel right. You got to do something different, even if it's going to give it kind of a different tone or a different story. And I love that this one went with a different tone. It went with the familiar characters from the first movie. You had, you know, a new hitchhiker for this one, which was brilliantly played by God damn it, what's his name again?
Bill Moseley,
that's right. The epic Bill Moseley playing the epic Chop Top, who is just so many great lines from the "lick my plate, you dog dick." You've got, you know, they're dragging around the corpse of the hitchhiker from the first one. At least I think that's what it's meant to be. I've always loved this one a lot. I don't know if I like it more than the first one than so much of just I like it as its own film. Like, it manages to do something really good as what it is, as more of a kind of satirical slasher movie, super ultra violent, very, very neon and packed full of 80s sleaze. Whereas the first one almost looks like a, like an accident video, like for like a construction site showing you what not to do and how messed up you can get. It has that very grimy and dirty, dangerous sort of feel to it. So I love both of the movies for different merits. And I think it's a solid follow-up sequel. I think it's a solid example of how to do a sequel right. So I think out of the three, Tobe Hooper canon films. I'd say Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2 is among my favorites. And I remember I'm the opposite of Brandon. I saw this movie when I was young as well, and I loved it when I first saw it. In fact, I saw 2 before I saw 1, so I was expecting Chainsaw 1 to be more like 2 and was like, oh, well, this is pretty goddamn different. It's a lot gloomier, but I still like what I'm seeing. Yeah, I think it's a solid film, and it deserved to do so much better because just in terms of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre sequels, it's easily one of the best. I think they kind of stopped being good after the third one. Next Generation was a pile of crap. The remakes were completely pointless. That new one that just came out, the prequel, then that other Michael Bay looking Platinum Dunes pile of crap. So I think it was part of the glory years of when Leatherface was still very much relevant and actually awesome and scary, and the movies were actually interesting.
Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2, the first time that I saw it, I actually came in about the halfway point, and because I was at a party and they had it playing. Watching it, and I'm like, what the hell is this? And they're like, it's Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2. And I'm like, no, it isn't. I'm like, because there's like, why is it funny? Like, this can't possibly be right. So, you know, I got to watching it, and you know, there's Chainsaw Foo with Dennis Hopper and Stretch, and I'm just like, this, the hell's going on? Bill Moseley, well, at the time, I didn't know really who Bill Moseley was, but it was like, he keeps picking dead skin off of his metal plate on his, like, what the hell is going on? I went, you know, watched the whole thing. Well, watched what was left of it, maybe, you know, 40 minutes or so. And then I was like, all right, I have to go see this thing from the beginning. So maybe a week later or so, I went and rented it and watched it. And I was like, all right, I don't know why he went comedy wise, but this is really funny, and I liked it, and it kind of grew on me. Like, I enjoyed it, but I was just kind of so confused because probably the way that Golden Globus were, it was like, I wasn't expecting this to be you know, a comedy satire, but it's what it ended up being. And as far as why it succeeded, probably off of the back of the original, it had such a history behind it, and people wanted to see the movie again. And I mean, the first one was such a monumental hit that they were like, oh, you know, Tobe Hooper's back and he's directing the sequel. This is going to be amazing. And I think that it probably succeeded because it's just such a bizarre and entertaining movie. And I would like to think that audiences got it, which is why it did well. But who's to say? I mean, it could be one or the other, either that they enjoyed it because it ended up being so ridiculous, or they went in expecting Texas Chainsaw 1 and got a different experience.
Well, this film was a disaster behind the scenes. They decided to shoot this in Texas in what turned out to be at that time the hottest summer on record. So that did not help matters at all. He said crew were literally passing out from heat exhaustion, which also didn't help with all of the meat that they had to have on set for set dressing. Makeup kept literally melting off some of the actors after, you know, not only is it the hottest summer on record, all of the hot lights you need. So he said some of these rooms that, like, they were shooting in for all of the tunnels could get up to 110 degrees with the lights, which just, and the fact that his budget was cut didn't help. Golan and Globus actually cut his budget so much, they sent their comptroller to the set to count every penny he was spending. So he had an accountant standing there going, do you really need that light? So that's not really good to induce real creativity right there. And no. Then there are a bunch of deleted scenes from these movies besides Joe Bob Briggs. And I think for once, thankfully deleted. For instance, okay, they already had Dennis Hopper's character of Lefty as the uncle of Sally and Franklin Hardesty from the first film. Okay, you're stretching credulity a little bit. He was also supposed to be Stretch's long-lost father. And that's why he cared so much about rescuing Stretch. And I'm like, okay, I get it that you're going for a satire, but thank God that subplot was dropped.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, there's no way to know how it would have affected the film if it was inserted, but it just seems like unnecessary. The movie is perfectly fine without it. And honestly, I kind of like the fact that part of the reason Dennis Hopper was going in the tunnels after Stretch was just because he was such a psycho. I kind of like that explanation.
I think it's good that they left that out. I think it would have made it, even if it was meant to be kind of satirical by like going really far with the backstory and trying to tie it in that much with the first movie and sort of playing it for laughs, it ultimately would have just made the movie too convoluted.
Yeah, sometimes when you're in the filming process, things seem like a really good idea. And then as they come together, you realize that it's not a good idea. So that's something that they decided was a bad idea and they dropped it and they were in the right in doing so.
Well, one bad idea that did make it into the film that Tom Savini openly criticizes is some of the edits and some of the length of the edits of some of his special effects shots. He thinks they left in too much gore. For instance, when the yuppie is getting his head slashed in half, he thought they would leave that on camera for a second or two and then cut away. He's vocally unhappy with how long they held that shot. He said, you can see how ridiculously fake that effect is by holding it for 8 fucking seconds the way they did to show the blood squirting out. He's like, that should have been a 2-second shot. At an 8 seconds, you see how fake it is.
I think he's being way too hard on himself. That was a good effect.
Actually, it's not. It looked really goofy, the way the head was bouncing and the obviously fake hands. I got to go with Savini on this one. That shot was held way too long. And he said throughout the whole movie it was that. The editor seemed to have reveled in the gore to the point where he didn't know when too much was too much. I got to go with that. The movie could be tightened a little.
Yeah, probably. I don't know. It just kind of added to the campiness of it. I think Savini, he's a master at his craft. So I'm going to kind of err in favor of him as far as, you know, oh, it doesn't look as good. But the thing is, like, you know, we're all critical of everything that we do. You know, oh, I could have edited this better, or I could have shot this better, or I could have, you know, cut this here, or done this here.
Cecil could try being right for once.
I certainly could, you know, and you kind of come to a point where, especially in something like this, where you're doing a job for someone else. So you create this thing, you give it to them, you give them the end product, and then they take it and edit it. And of course, you're going to be like, oh, it should have done this, or they should have cut it here. So I don't think that it was bad. I think that he's just being nitpicky because it was more or less his baby.
I'd agree with him more if the movie was supposed to be like a truly gritty, horrifying movie like the first one. But I think the fact that the gore is so over the top kind of works with the tone it's going for. I understand, like, okay, yeah, you probably could have trimmed some things, but I don't think the amount of gore being in there ruins the movie at all.
Critics did not like this film. Like I said, this one actually made almost double its budget. It's not a bad criticism, but it's a fair criticism of the 3 Tobe Hooper films, is he was given essentially a blank check. When he signed his 3-picture deal with Canon, it was to make Space Vampires, but then he had his pick for his next 2 films to fill out that contract, and he didn't do anything original. He had an adaptation, a remake, and a sequel. A lot of people were like, Toby, we want to see a Tobe Hooper film. What do you want to make that's your idea? You know, that's not a sequel or a remake or an adaptation. I think that's a fair criticism. It's not necessarily a bad thing that he made adaptations. That's fine. But I think it's fair that he was given free rein and didn't try to do anything original with it. That, I think, says something about his cocaine problem at the time. And I'm not slighting the guy. He admits he had a massive cocaine problem when he worked for Canon. Should Tobe Hooper have used his 3-picture deal to make something unique or to just make... I don't mean this word as bad as it sounds, but derivative works.
Well, I mean, Life Force was his foot in the door.
Is what got him signed. So I'm not blaming that as an adaptation, but his next two being a remake and a sequel.
Well, I mean, look at Peter Jackson. You know, he does the Lord of the Rings trilogy. He can do any movie he wants. They're like, whatever you want to do. And he wants to do a really super expensive remake of King Kong. So I kind of look at it from the perspective of, was most likely a fan of the original Invaders from Mars and wanted to put his own spin on it to a certain degree. And that's what he did. And then with Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2, he wanted to do a follow up to a movie that, you know, was what put him on the map and put, again, a different spin on it. So I don't know. Maybe there wasn't anything really like exciting him at the time. Maybe he didn't really have any great ideas of things that he could have done that he wanted to do, but so he wanted to take some two things that he was already familiar with and kind of continue along with that. I mean, the other thing too is you don't know what was going on behind the scenes. They might have been like, okay, well, Life Force wasn't a hit. You know, you want to do this movie? We're not going to give you that much money. And then after things were kind of awry with Invaders from Mars, they were like, all right, well, let's go back to your roots. And he went back to Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2, but he ended up putting his own different spin on it by making it a satire. I mean, the truth is somewhere in the middle. And most likely, I mean, half of Golan Globus is dead, so they're not going to talk about it. And Tobe Hooper now has nothing but high, you know, nice things to say about his time with Canon. He says, you know, if he had had the opportunity, he probably would still be making movies for them.
Go back and read articles in Fangoria and Starlog at the time. He was not so complimentary.
I know, but I'm talking now, which is why I'm saying that we're never going to really find out the full stories of them.
So wait a second. You're saying a filmmaker in the mid-80s had a cocaine problem? Really?
I know. Wow. Weird, huh?
That worked for Canon Films?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, man.
Like you were saying, he can't be, you know, Life Force was his entry into this deal, so I think he gets a pass for that one. Regarding Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2, I would bet you anything as soon as the box office returns for Life Force came in, he was probably under huge pressure from Canon to be like, all right, you better deliver something that is going to make money. So the logical thing to do is like, all right, well, I'll make a sequel to my best known film that's probably got the best shot. So even Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2, I don't blame him for that. The one thing where you could kind of level this criticism at him is with the Invaders from Mars remake. Would it have been nice to see some weird original idea from him instead of that? Sure, but yeah, maybe he was just a big fan of the original movie and just wanted to put his take on it. Who knows?
I don't know if I would necessarily call them derivative. I mean, yeah, sure, Life Force is an adaptation, but it's incredibly different from the source material. Dan O'Bannon went and sort of did his own thing, and Toby really, really brought his A game to the direction of that film, and it looks fantastic, and everybody involved in it did an awesome job. Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2, yeah, it's a sequel, but it's completely different from his first film, and he made a completely different film. It's almost a self-parody, but not like a self-deprecating one. He ended up making a great movie out of that. And even with Invaders from Mars, like, there was a trend at that time in the 80s where, you know, remakes of classic horror movies were coming out. You know, you had John Carpenter's The Thing. You had David Cronenberg's Fly. So that was something that seemed to be marketable, something that was well-received as a sort of an 80s modern look at how this movie could have been done. And obviously Invaders from Mars didn't really hit its mark all that well. It was a little too much of a beat for beat remake, but I don't fault him too much for it. I think as we were saying with guys like Peter Jackson and stuff like that, he just wanted to make a movie that he was probably a fan of growing up and wanted to do his own spin on it. And there are aspects of it that are really cool, and there are other ones where it kind of falls flat. I don't know. Not every filmmaker is going to put out stuff that everybody likes all the time. I think it is one of his weaker films, but I don't know. I wouldn't really call it derivative. It's just, I guess it's just something he wanted to do to probably pay tribute to a movie that he digs.
That's fair. But then unfortunately with all of these movies, with the first two tanking and the third film, Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2, not making enough to make up for the first two tanking, Canon was also facing their own problems at this point. Their bad paper and some of their business practices were starting to catch up with them, and then they would start their collapse the following year. Some people blamed Tobe Hooper for that by them giving him so much money and him not being able to deliver on anything. Canon at this point was pumping out $1 million Death Wish sequels that were making $4 million opening weekend. So Tobe Hooper was almost one of the only people working for Canon that was consistently underperforming for them. So some people blame Tobe Hooper for Canon's eventual fall. I'm not sure I'd go that far, but these films failing at the box office is definitely a factor that has to be brought into it. That said, going back and looking at these three films from a 2016 perspective, do you think modern audiences have reappraised all three of these films, or are they still the obscurities that never made their money back in the 80s.
I think they've reappraised Life Force and Texas Chainsaw Massacre to a small extent. In my opinion, I hope that continues, because I think both of them deserve more attention and more respect than they get. The one outlier is Invaders from Mars. That one's still sort of forgotten. It's a movie that you might see on, I don't know, on TNT at 2 a.m., and that's kind of it. But yeah, with the other two, there's been a slight reappraisal of them recently with the internet. I hope it goes further, because I think both those movies deserve better reputations than what their box office and their critical reception at the time would indicate.
I'd say they've been reappraised. I've always kind of considered all three of those to be the sort of casual B-movie watcher movie, like the one that sort of people who get into stuff like Troma or Maniac Cop or whatever, like kind of just randomly getting into movies like that, tend to know about TCM2, Life Force, and Invaders from Mars. I consider them to be semi-well-known, like, cult films, and it'd be nice if they became even more well-known, because Life Force doesn't really deserve to just be known as, like, a cheesy B or Z movie. It deserves to be known as, like, a rather epic sci-fi film. Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2 deserves more praise as well, but I'm pretty happy with the fact that people do at least know about it, and I really don't think it's fair for canon to blame Toby Hooper for their downfall. Like, obviously they did give the guy a lot of money, but they also mismarketed the shit out of his films. They didn't advertise them the way that they should have been advertised. They didn't release the cuts that they should have released. So it's kind of harsh to pay the guy out like that and then claim that he was the reason for their downfall. But I mean, they didn't even market his films correctly. They had a lot of bombs. They did do very well with their Charles Bronson and their Chuck Norris vehicles. Like, I think it goes without saying that Delta Force is probably one of the biggest action movies of the 80s, and canon put it out. Everybody fucking knows about Delta Force, but I doubt they even know that.
And Invasion USA.
And Invasion USA, and I don't think anybody knows, or at least people do, but most people, like the majority, have no idea that it was put out by this, like, little middle-class filmmaking company that was Canon Films. Like, a lot of people consider those Chuck Norris films to be huge, like, action blockbusters that dominated the 80s, and they did, but they were put out by a little company. So Canon did have that. They did know what to do with some of their bigger action names, but they did also have a lot of bombs. And unfortunately, some of those Toby Hooper movies were some of those bombs, but I wouldn't blame him for that.
No, I think at the very least, Life Force and Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2 have been reappraised. I know the fan base was growing faster for Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2, but within the past few years, Life Force has really gotten a resurgence. And I saw there was a thing with Stephen Railsback where he was talking about how, you know, he has 88 credits to his name, movies, television, all kinds of stuff. And he says the thing that most people still, you know, have been coming up to him about is Life Force. They're like, I absolutely love that movie. I thought that you did a brilliant performance in it. And he's got some big stuff behind him. So for people to...
He played Charles Manson in the 70s.
Yeah, he played Charles Manson with Marilyn Burns in Helter Skelter. And that was actually how...
That's actually how he met Toby Hooper.
Toby Hooper.
Yeah, Toby Hooper was visiting Marilyn Burns on the set of Helter Skelter. He said Steve Railsback terrified him because he wouldn't come out of character. So he's like, I got to make a movie with this guy.
He, you know, for a movie like that, you know, roughly 30 years later, to still be getting somebody to who has his career that they still have people coming up to him and talking about. I mean, that right there says that it's kind of gone beyond just being an underground thing, especially now that it's been released on Blu-ray. And so people are actually seeing the correct version. I think a lot of people are now understanding what some people have made a fuss over. It's like, oh, wait, this is actually a really amazing movie. When
also bring into the fact that Patrick Stewart has been a champion of Life Force ever since it came out. He was on, I can't remember if it was The Tonight Show or David Letterman, he was on some late night talk show in the late 90s, and they were asking him about, like, you know, your on-screen kisses, and he pointed out his first on-screen kiss was by Steve Railsback in Life Force. Mm-hmm. And the host was like, what? So Patrick Stewart is he's been a champion of this film. He's not ashamed of being in this movie.
No, he's even said of all the directors he's worked with in his entire career, Tobe Hooper was his favorite.
You know, you get some people that are huge stars when they look at their sci-fi movies that they got their start in. Patrick Stewart's not ashamed of Life Force at all.
Oh, absolutely not. You can tell he gave his all in that role. He was easily one of the highlights. He played that role with absolutely no restraint.
Which is what it needed. I mean, he had to make out with Steve Railsback by having a space vampire chick inside his body.
Exactly.
You know, that can't be easy to get into
just
method-wise.
Just that scene where he's like, I forget if it was like the asylum cell or like jail cell, and he's just like screaming his fucking head off.
Yeah.
Like he's just completely letting go of any control and just getting completely immersed in the role. And I think he brings so much to that movie, and it's no surprise at all that he champions it and, you know, has such a high regard for Tobe Hooper, because he clearly had a blast making that movie.
And that's the thing. I think the movies have been reappraised. Even Invaders from Mars. It recently came out. The Shout Factory, Scream Factory just did a special edition of that. 10 years ago, who would have ever thought the 1986 Invaders from Mars would ever get a special edition at all, let alone the lavish, loving one that it got? So I think even Invaders from Mars, which we've kind of crapped on in this episode, it has been reappraised as well. I think all three of Tobe Hooper's films have been reappraised, and I think it was just Canon mismarketed these. Hooper didn't have creative control to the point of, you know, the final edits in most of the cases. And I think just 1985, 1986 were a couple of bad years for him, and he just needed to wait for these movies to find their due. So Canon is no more, but Peter is still around. Where can people find him if they wish to?
You can find me on the Twitters at Cinematica, YouTube, The Cinemasochist, Facebook, The Cinemasochist, and on 1201beyond.com with some merch coming pretty soon. You want a Cinemasochist t-shirt? You want a Cinemasochist phone case? Maybe a pair of Cinemasochist Macho Man style 80s glasses? Mosey on over to 1201beyond.com. Check out some of the other awesome shit on there too. I believe Josh is on there as well.
Imagine that. It's only my site. Cecil is always wrong, but if you want to find him, you could do so where?
Oh, I am right. You know it.
Or left.
I am at escapistmagazine.com. I'm also on YouTube and then Facebook and Twitter.
And he actually, Good Bad Flicks is actually a bad show. I just like giving him crap.
Oh, yeah. Oh, and goodbadflicks.com too, if you want to go there. But yeah. Hooray.
It's a ritzy little operation.
It is a ritzy operation for fancy gentlemen like myself.
And Brandon, where can people find you and your unique bad movie reviews?
Oh, well, I was actually thinking of trademarking cult reviews, just like the Fine Bros trademarked React, but we'll see how that goes. But yeah, you can find me on YouTube. Just search Brandon Tenold and I should come up. I'm also on Twitter at Brandon Tenold and on Facebook on Official Brandon Tenold. And
ooh,
as
official.
Just one final thing, I wonder if anybody comes up to Steve Railsback today and says, "I loved you in Nuki."
I think that's the end of the show. Have a good night and keep one foot in the gutter, one fist in the gold.
Don't forget, we've only got so many tricks. No one lives forever. It's all that it is, my friend.
No one lives forever.
Let's have a party. There's a full moon in the sky. It's the hour of the wolf, and I don't want to die. I'm so happy dancing while the grimmer in for cuts, cuts, cuts.
Beyond production. Visit 1201beyond.com for more great shows.